So I think we ought to do a little bit of biog first.
We probably ought to do that, absolutely.
Just to introduce you to everybody, Andy. Where do you come from originally? Because you've lived everywhere.
Not everywhere, but I'm a Londoner. So I grew up in South London. South. Oh, fantastic. Which part of London? Oh, well, no one's perfect. But so grew up in South London and then moved to North London. So I did go to your neck of the woods and then to the Aylesbury area, actually a small village called Aston Clinton. But we discovered that Helen was born in Aylesbury, so there's a connection there.
We were married in Aylesbury.
Really? So there you go. All the best people. There we go. And then we moved, my wife and I moved to Toronto in Canada. And we were 6 years out in Toronto. We went out just the two of us and we came back with two kids. Kids of our own, by the way, not ones we just stolen. So we actually produced two Canadians. We moved from there. We came back from Toronto to Dundee in Scotland. So we were there for 6 years. And then we moved in 2022 to just outside Swindon, on the down in Wiltshire. So Swindon, you know, yeah, Venice on the M4, I like to think of it. England's second capital city.
if you can imagine the railway lines are canals, then it's Venice on the M4.
That's very underrated.
Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah, that's my kind of where I've been. So, sort of all over the UK.
We both have some Scottish things in common, so we've been talking about those and other things.
We do.
Not kilts, though.
No. One occasion I did do it. It was at a Cayley, and I wore a kilt. Never again.
Cayleys we probably have in common, but not kilts.
Not recommended unless you know what you're doing. Yeah.
Okay, so we have this book, and we have some copies to you're free to take away and enjoy. Tell us about this book. Have you ever wondered? I mean, I've wondered about lots of things, and quite a lot of them will be in here, actually.
So let me back up from that slightly. So the bridge to talk about the book is I work for a Scottish organisation, although based now across the UK, called SOLAS. SOLAS is the Gaelic word for light. Some kind of connection to English too, because of course we have solar. It's the same word root somewhere. And so SOLAS really does a couple of things. We're a Christian organisation concerned with really taking the message of the Christian faith out of the four walls of churches and into the public square. So we do loads of events, Jim, in places like this, audiences of this size, smaller, larger, loads of stuff on university campuses, schools, workplaces, online. We do a lot of media kind of stuff. And then the other half, what we do is working in churches, helping Christians be better prepared to talk to their friends who don't share their faith about the big questions of life, which means thinking about the big questions of life is kind of my job, really. I speak, I write, I broadcast, and so forth. And we noticed that the colleague and I, Gavin, who kind of co-edited Have You Ever Wondered? So it's co-written by, co-edited by me and a colleague, but we've got 10 different authors in here. We noticed a few years ago, 2-3 years ago now, there was really kind of a surging interest, I guess, in spiritual questions, let's put it that way, particularly among younger audiences, not just younger audiences, there's all ages here tonight, but particularly among, I would say, take like 25 as a cutoff. You and I were talking about this earlier, right? When I go to schools, when I do universities, when I do events outside the church walls, to go, the huge interest in younger people among spiritual questions. But the way they're coming into those questions, many of them don't have any kind of church background. But they're beginning to ask questions like, well, you know, why does human rights matter? Why does science work? Does it matter what's true? You know, why am I drawn to things like beauty and love? You know, why does art and stories and music move us? Those were the kind of questions that were animating.
So these are not the questions that Christians have generally thought people wanted to ask. They're several steps back, right?
Yeah. Or even actually, not even necessarily questions people outside the church were asking. So, you know, go back 10, 15 years, there was a movement called the New Atheism, popularly associated with people like Richard Dawkins from just up the road at Oxford. You know, his books and others like him selling millions of copies, you know, laying into the question, is there a God, right? That is not the question people are asking anymore. Often, actually, I find with younger folks, it's assumed, actually, people are assuming there's got to be something out there, but how do we make sense of it? So, yeah, the questions have changed, Jim. So we decided a year and a half ago to work on Have You Ever Wondered, put 28 of those questions into the book, each kind of like super short chapters, about 3-4 pages long. So if you're not really a reader, it's still something you can engage with. You can engage with it in any order. And it kind of went nuts. So we've gone through about 30,000 copies in the last kind of 10 months. Yeah. I've never been involved with a book that's gone this fast. And it's been a lot of fun. And it's a lot of fun talking about it at events
and
like this.
Just out of interest, you were recently in Norway.
Yes, I was. You're just sharing that for just general...
Just for interesting. And tell us about what happened in Norway.
Yes, in Norway, I was saying to...
I'm just not leaving a random fact.
No, it's not a random fact.
Tell us about what happened when you were in Norway.
My wife is part Norwegian, but that's not why I went. We went because I was doing an event at the University of Bergen. So Bergen is a town sort of about 2 hours from Oslo, the capital. And there was a group of Christian students there, about 50 or 60 of them, who for the last 15 years, there's been an event on that campus called Skeptics Week. So the Christian students get together, put on a series of evening events, coupled with lots of food and hospitality, invite their mates, and talk about the questions of life. So I was there this year as one of the speakers. We had about 50 Christian students who were like the kind of
big core.
The core. Yeah. But each night we were getting 150 to 200 people coming to the evening events, half of whom I think would probably not identify as being Christian in any shape or form. But the story I think I told you that you piqued your interest is every morning we got together with the Christian students and had a little pray for what was going on in the day. And on the Wednesday morning, so halfway through this week, one of the students said, oh, we need to pray because we're doing a follow-up course called Alpha that kind of starts this week, actually, where people get together and just explore big questions of life. And they said, we've got a room booked for 50 people, but 52 people have signed up to do this course. What should we do? At which I and several others shouted out, get a bigger room, which they did. And it started this week. And I think I said to you, I think it's 100, just 105 people coming. Now, what they told me was interesting. Last year, they had 50 people on this follow-up course and the year before 25. Yeah. So they've seen a doubling over the last
Something is happening.
There's an interest.
We're feeling that in churches as well.
Yeah.
We're getting new levels of interest. I've just spent 2 days with a group of pastors from our associated churches. That is the pattern across those churches.
That's very good. So, what's the collective noun for a group of pastors, Jim?
A murmuration conflagration. I don't know.
A murmuration. Murmuration, that's starling.
That's starling, isn't it? Actually. And we did more than murmur. So, I'll if I come up with a collective noun,
I throw one at you.
I'll
just
throw in it at the
what
end.
Was that, sorry? A twittering of pastors.
Actually, for some of us, abundantly so, yes. So there you go. Okay, so let's come to tonight's question, which we build as, have you ever wondered if we were made for a purpose?
There's a question.
So where do we start with this question?
There's a great question. Well, I think the reason you wanted to start with that question, I like starting with that question. We don't, by the way, in the book, we work up to that question. It is one of the massive questions you have to think about as a human being, right? Everybody, or most people at some point in their lives, ask the question of going, am I just an accident? Is my life totally worthless? Would it matter if I'd never been born? Those kinds of questions. And actually, if you don't get an answer to it, bad stuff happens. I'm doing a talk this weekend down in Bridgewater, and we're looking at the whole question of why we are right now. I've got this epidemic of anxiety going on in our culture. And more people are saying that those levels of anxiety that are off the charts, lots of psychologists have commented on this, is that it turns out if you don't have answers to questions like, what's the meaning of life? Does my life have value? Is there a purpose? Things don't go well for you in a whole level of range of things. So I think it's an important question to ask, but it also sets up a challenge, right? It does sort of set the option starkly in front of you, because if there is no God, if we just live in a purely material universe, if the only thing that exists are, you know, tables and pastors and phones and things, just atoms in motion,
and blood vessels, and
then
that
we have to be brutally honest, we don't have a purpose. We just are, really. If there is a God, that doesn't necessarily immediately answer the purpose question, but it makes an answer to the purpose question kind of more likely.
Yeah. So, but lots of people live their life without God and still find some kind of purpose. So,
well, there's two things going on, isn't there?
Let's explore some of those possibilities.
Well, the first thing is that we obviously need to tease out purpose, perhaps with a capital P. I'll do it this way around for the audience. There's purpose with a capital P and purpose with a small p. So you can certainly go out and decide, you know what, my purpose in life is going to be to, I don't know, I'm going to be an environmentalist, and I'm going to save the seals. That's what I'm going to do. They look cute on those postcards that Greenpeace always sends through my door. So I'm going to make the purpose of my life trying to campaign for, you know, that, so we see less, you know, seals clubbed to death in Greenland and Canada. Now, that's great. That might give you some sort of sense of purpose. The problem you run into is, firstly, it's purely random. It's not linked to any.
You might not be good at it.
You might not be good at it. The second problem is, what do you do when you bounce across me who says, well, this is interesting, Jim. My purpose in life is actually I hate seals. And I've decided my purpose in life is to club as many of the furry little critters to death as possible and make gloves out of their pelts. And I'm going to make a fortune selling those on eBay. That's my purpose. Well, now your purpose and my purpose are fundamentally at loggerheads.
Yeah.
And you can't appeal upwards to the universe.
There is nobody.
There is no upwards.
You've decided.
And so you end up there. So the problem you run into is why do anything? Why bother? So yeah, maybe at the best, if there is no God, you might come up with some little purpose that works for you. But if you're honest, you have to go, it doesn't actually matter. Because by the way, in the case of the seals, one day they're going to be extinct. One day you're going to be extinct. One day humanity will come to an end. One day the sun will expand and swallow the earth. One day everything just ends in the heat death of the universe. So quite frankly, do what you like. It makes no long-term difference.
Which is very nihilistic, isn't it?
It's a bit bleak, isn't it? It is a bit bleak, but it is interesting that I think one of the things I found interesting when I was researching for a previous book I wrote on atheism is actually there are a lot of atheist kind of writers and thinkers down through the ages who are willing to admit that, and I think with a sadness to it. Mm-hmm. Or in more contemporary terms, you've got someone like Lawrence M. Krauss. Lawrence is a physicist, cosmologist, atheist, very well known on the internet. And Lawrence has this lovely, very honest little quote that I sometimes use. He says, you know, human beings are 1% bit of pollution in the universe. We are completely irrelevant. And I would say there's a reason.
Let me get that again.
We are 1% bit of pollution in the universe.
There's the universe and we're just 1% of it.
Well, the worrying thing is actually. If you calculate the percentage of atoms in the universe and the percentage of atoms in the universe that are being
human tiny.
Beings.
We're a lot less than
1%. We're actually 1 times 10 to the minus 50th, I think, percent. Which is quite insignificant. There's a reason that Lawrence is a cosmologist and not a motivational speaker, I think.
He gets lost in the statistics.
But the point is he's honest and he's real.
Yeah.
And I think he doesn't believe in God, and that's what it is. Just suck it up.
Well, in the sort of 30s, 40s, 50s, after Nazism, after World War II.
I wasn't alive back then, but I'll take your word for it.
I look like I was, but if you're going back to that sort of period in history, 45,
yes.
50, the war is over. We've defeated Nazism. Sadly, we've not defeated communism. And suddenly people have got, you know, great new scientific discoveries.
Yes.
We were watching the rerun of the film about the discovery of DNA, the Horizon Project.
Oh, Crick and Watson.
Crick and Watson
guys,
and so on. And suddenly people think they're making great discoveries as though we're getting to it, but I can't remember whether it was Crick or Watson came to the conclusion that at the end of the day, we are just the product of our DNA.
It was actually Francis Crick, who, again, in my whole of, you know, everyone needs a hobby, and I collect depressing little quotes from atheist scientists, everyone needs a hobby. And I think he said that we are nothing but a pack of neurons.
Yeah.
That's all that we are. We're just atoms in motion.
And we might as well, go to bed with whoever we want or destroy whatever we want.
Nothing actually ultimately matters.
There is no real meaning or morality. Now, a lot of people are trying to find something to fill that gap. So what kind of things might they fill that gap with?
Well, I think the first thing I'd say, Jim, is the very fact that we want to fill that gap. The very fact that rarely do I go, in fact, I can't think I've ever gone, say, into an audience where, in fact, take a university audience, right, where you've got perhaps, the Norway crowd last week. If I'd stood up and said, we are just a 1% bit of pollution in the universe, who here agrees? We'd have had about half the people in the room, 100 or so, didn't believe in God at that point. I don't think any would have raised their hands and gone, yeah, I agree with that. We resist that. Even if you don't have a faith, you tend to, you know, there's something instinctively in us. It's like, well, hang on, that can't be right. Or when we see injustice, no matter what we believe or don't believe, most human beings, if you're wired properly and you see an injustice, whether you've got a faith or no faith, you shout out something's not right here.
Yeah.
So I find it interesting that we do have that tendency to look elsewhere. And then the other thing that we tend to do, I think, Jim, is that kind of God-shaped hole, as it were, that I think many people have commented, human beings sort of have within them, you do find that if you don't fill it with God, other stuff gets stuck putting in there. What we tend to do is we tend to take sort of everyday things and we maximize them. So we make, you know, science the center of the universe. Science is great, but it's not a good idea to make it the center of everything. Or we do it with money or possessions or performance at work, or for students we do it with grades. We make something the center of everything, and then what tends to happen, that thing lets us down at some point. You know, if you make your job the center of your life, and heaven forbid you're made redundant, well, then you haven't just lost your job, you've lost your entire meaning in life. Mm. And it's really hard.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I would say for myself as a Christian minister that if I had a stroke and lost the power of speech, that would be a massive, and it's something I worry about increasingly, you know, that would be, the danger is that I've invested too much in my role.
I think so. And I think the other thing is that we also live in an age, as a friend of mine in Canada coined the phrase, I heard him once say to an audience a bit like this in a cafe, he said, the problem is in the modern Western world, we live in an age where it's all become about PBA, which I thought was very clever because people like acronyms, right? People are now going, what is PBA? Is that a thing? Well, PBA, when he explained it, stands for performance-based acceptance. We live in an age that tells you, if you perform, you know, some of you are nodding, right? You're accepted. You don't work, if you perform, you're accepted. If you're a student, you get the right grades, you're accepted. If you're into sport, you perform, you're accepted. Social media runs this way. You know, if you tweet the right thing, you get the likes. If you tweet the wrong thing,
you get the dopamine rush from...
You get the pylon. So we live in a very judgmental age.
Yeah.
And again, the trouble with that is that it's a huge stress if you're living your life thinking, well, if I don't perform, you know, in relationships, right, counselors and psychologists will tell you this is a disaster. If you think, well, if I don't perform the right way, my partner is going to reject me, then the anxiety and nervousness that's going to inculcate, we need something underneath us that is not based, holding us up, that's not based on performance, which, by the way, as a Christian, I would say, takes you right into the area of who God is and what he's done for us in Jesus, but we'll come more to that as we go.
Okay, you've talked a lot about, you know, scientists, tertiary education, people up there, the big achievers.
Well, they would say so.
They would say so.
Exactly. What science ever done
is
for
that
us?
Pricking the bubble of...
What the Romans ever done,
know,
for us?
The PhD student who can tell you everything about Genghis Khan, but nothing else.
Well, speaking as someone who's got a PhD, somebody once, my supervisor when I was doing my academic sort of side of my life, humbled me by saying, just remember that people who've got advanced degrees... I've just very got specialised ignorance.
Yeah.
Most people are ignorant about ordinary things. PhDs and university types are ignorant about very specialised things.
Yeah, and they spend a year writing it up and 10 people will read it.
10?
10. As many as 10?
As many as 10. I wish.
It is very humbling to discover that, isn't it?
It is.
Sorry, back to
your question.
Yeah, so I'm just thinking... Descartes has a wonderful road sweeper. He's quite a character because he's got black rimmed glasses and a wonderful walrus moustache.
And he's lazy.
Oh dear.
He's lazy.
Well,
I wouldn't,
whenever
I
see him, he's picking up things that I wouldn't be bothered to pick up, so I'm impressed.
That's a
£10 note,
it's called.
Well, I wouldn't dream of that.
Now, I'm just thinking, supposing
in
my life I hadn't been this loudmouth minister with a church to look after, I'd been a road sweeper. Would I have purpose?
Yes.
Oh, look at that. The audience behind you, Jim. Well, I'd say a couple of things. Yeah, I mean, firstly, let's take this two ways. If we live in a godless universe, I always love playing the counterfactuals, playing the opposites, right? Okay, if we live in a purely material universe, you do raise a great question, because one of the things we want to believe as a society is that all people are born equal, right? I know that's the American Constitution, but we believe that here too, that it doesn't matter your ability, your skills, your earning potential, your gender, your race, your background. We love this idea that all men and women are equal. So the road sweeper is equal to the university professor.
Yeah.
But take God out of the equation for a moment and go, on what conceivable basis? It's totally, it's nonsense. It's nonsense on stilts, quite frankly, because going, he's down here, the high and the mighty are up there. How on earth do we get any sense of equality into the picture unless we have something outside of humanity to give us that kind of basis? That's the first thing. Secondly, of going, yeah, I mean, he could decide that his purpose in life is just to keep the roads clean, but ultimately one day he'll get flattened by the number 93 bus or by an angry resident who thinks he's lazy or just like lamping one. And, yeah, there we go. And the road's no longer clean. And the interesting thing is this, you and I were chatting about the road sweeping before and saying, so firstly, on the Christian story, there's an equality between all of us because we're all we all bear what the Bible calls the image of God. We're all created by God. Yeah, we have different skills and abilities, but the point of
can you just unpack that idea? You talk very fast, Andy, and I just want to slow you down and hang on a minute. Let's unpack that as an idea. What do we mean by human beings are made in the image of God? Because that's quite foundational.
It's a foundational idea, isn't it? That human beings are not just the stuff of which we are made, but that when God called humanity into being and created humankind, he also breathed his spirit into us. So there is something that reflects our maker in each one of us. And that's not based on our ability, our skills, the color of our skin, our gender, any of those things. It is what unites humanity together.
We have a conscience.
And all those things.
And we worship and we rejoice.
And that gives us by the way, that gives you an amazing ability, an amazing foundation at that point for human rights straight away, because you can say there is something worthwhile about every man and woman and child, no matter their ability. So your road sweeper is the same value as the prime minister, even though some of us might be tempted to reverse that depending on our politics. Secondly, the other thing we were talking about before that intrigued me is a generation or two ago, well, certainly 100 years ago, when Christian faith was more widespread at that point, and I think it was sort of more widely disseminated in society. One of the questions that you need to think about as a human being is, why am I doing the job that I'm doing? Now, you might be lucky and do a job that you absolutely love. You might be unlucky and do a job that you struggle with. You go into work each day and think, why am I here? Now, maybe the road sweeper loves his job. Maybe he wishes he was doing something else. Or you get jobs like a lot of us do, where perhaps 70% of our job we love and 30% is just grind. Well, why do you work is an interesting question. And in an increasingly secular culture, really the only argument for that is, well, I work because it brings money in. That's the most common answer you get, which is fine to an extent, but you get a problem, right? Because then it makes it very one-dimensional. You get very angry if you're not getting what you think you're worth and so on. You get employee set against employer. It's all very fraught.
And the argument for higher pay is, my job is awful, isn't it? You know, it's the Lloyd George and the miners in the mines holding, you know, the world ready to crush them and all that sort of stuff.
If you believe in some kind of God, the Christian answer to the question, why work? Traditionally, sure, it was a worker is worth their wages. The Bible has that line in it, actually. But it's also, you have the ability to say, I'm working because I'm working to glorify God. You know, you can try and be the best road sweeper you can because there's something about honouring God in doing that. You can be the best teacher, the best nuclear physicist, the best whoever. And again, once you take faith out, as our society has tried to do, I think, for the past, 100 years or so, you end up with all kinds of problems when you try and structure a society purely based upon what you can get out of the picture.
John Stott, the famous Christian preacher and writer, has this illustration of three men breaking stones in a quarry. And one of them, you go up to the first one and say, what are you doing? And he says, I'm just breaking stones to earn some money to keep my family. And the second one says something along the lines of, well, the first one says, I'm just breaking a stone. The second one says, I'm earning a living to provide for my family. And the third one says, I am shaping a stone to be included in a cathedral that can be used for the glory of God. So,
interesting.
Yeah, you know, it looks mundane, but it has a purpose. And
it can bring a glory to it, right? Mm. Very good.
Now, how do we apply that more widely? Because not everybody makes stone for cathedrals, you know.
No, this is very true.
And we've got increasingly technical jobs, haven't we?
Yeah. I think
data and web creation and railways and.
But I think the key thing in that
engineering.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think the key thing in that story that you tell of the three guys breaking the rock in the quarry, I think you can update and apply it because you can say, again, if you believe in some kind of God, if you don't believe in God, the first two options, the only ones you have, they're okay. Let's not be totally negative, but they only get you so far. I think if you hold to that third belief, that does allow you to say, do you know what? Actually, if I'm breaking stones in the quarry, I'm doing it for the glory of God. And by the way, even if I'm not building a cathedral, if I'm just building a wall for the local farmer, then I'm still doing something that reflects the glory of God because God has designed me to be a stonemason. If you've been an engineer, you can say, well, you know what? God has designed me to be an engineer, so I can do that to the very best of my ability. Yes, because I'll earn some money. And yes, because I'll serve my fellow humanity and there's something good in that. But you can go bigger than that.
Mm-hmm.
You can also say I'm actually bringing honor and glory to the God who made me. And I think one of the things that it took me a while actually of following Jesus into my Christian faith, Jim, to work out what it meant to be a Christian in the workplace. My first job was for the health service. I now work for a Christian organization, but I started out in the NHS. And I think it was probably 5-6 years working in the health service before I suddenly realized, do you know what? Organizing medical training, which is what my job was, I was an events organizer for a hospital. I can do that to the glory of God. I can try and do it in a way to the best of my ability, but there's something of worship about it as well. And that perspective, and I think it changes everything. And by the way, I'm a huge believer that one of the mistakes that the church allowed to happen and that has got us into the mess that we're partly in is we allowed ourselves to get into the mindset that said, God's stuff belongs in the church. Yeah. Everything else out here has nothing to do with church. And now I totally get it.
Secular, but
now I totally get it when I talk to people who haven't got any kind of religious faith, who are like, well, what has God got to do with me? I'm an engineer. Or, you know, what's God got to do with me? I'm a teacher.
Yeah.
You go, actually, it's got everything to do with you.
Yeah.
Because I think if Christianity is true, it affects everything.
Yeah.
But it was the church that partly we need to take the blame for not helping that discussion.
Okay, so we're saying we can have a good, everyday, positive. We want a clean street down the middle of Didcot, and so we're glad someone sweeps it. We want houses to live in, so we're glad someone makes bricks and somebody else, you know, lays them correctly and so on. But this is a bigger purpose that we're sort of striving after here. Do you want to unpack that a little bit more for us? So what does it mean to say I am actually made for a bigger purpose than just time and... how far does this go as an idea?
Yeah. Well, just again, I think let's start with a little purpose for a moment, Jim. I think if there is no God, even those little purposes collapse because you run into the problem that I think so many who've thought more deeply about these things down through the ages run into, that if ultimately the story of your life is that you are going to die, one day your children will die, one day the human race will become extinct, one day the sun will expand and swallow the earth and everything ends, then it doesn't matter how you've swept the road, it doesn't matter how you've built the cathedral, it doesn't matter how you've done your engineering, it all ends, and the outcome is exactly the same.
And it was pointless in the end.
And it was completely pointless. It was literally pointless. So as one, you know, as some writers have said in the past, you know, it was absurd. You know, life is a joke in some ways. So it's not just the big purpose. However, if there is a God, then I think not merely does that invest our little everyday purposes with meaning and light and bigger things. It does mean the potential that there is a bigger purpose behind humanity and behind your life and my life. And I think the Bible's answer to that question would be to say, well, actually primarily we're created for two things. Firstly, we are created that we might come to love God and know him and enjoy that relationship. We're not just designed to just be, you know, sort of little automata, little mammals who run around creating chaos. We're more than that. You know, God has actually created us to be sons and daughters. But also we're designed for relationship with one another. Those relationships really, really matter. Such that if I do something to grieve, upset, or offend you, that's not just a sort of thing between two humans. Actually, God is involved in that picture because we're back to you bearing God's image. And it's interesting that Jesus, on one occasion was famously asked by a lawyer. You know, lawyers back then were causing trouble, as they are today.
Yeah.
You know, what's
careful? I could have been a lawyer. So.
There we go. Well, of course, my parents live in, my family live in Somerset.
Right.
And I'm struck by the fact that if you say lawyer in a Somerset accent, it sounds like liar, doesn't it? He's a little lawyer.
Yeah.
Anyway, back to lawyers. So a lawyer asked Jesus, you know, there's all these hundreds of laws in the Old Testament and in Judaism. You know, what's the most important of all of them?
Yeah.
And Jesus, of course, cheekily didn't just give one answer. He gave two. He said, everything, all of it comes down to two things. Love God with your heart, mind, and soul, and love your neighbor as yourself. But those things go together. They're deliberately together, because if there is no God, my neighbor is just a collection of atoms. It might be a very handsome collection of atoms, but that's all you're... I saw who laughed over there when I said that. So yes.
Once.
So that's the big purpose. And that means that the big purpose of who God is and who we are connects up with the little purposes as well.
Yeah.
And the whole of life then gets invested with meaning.
So what other questions do we need to be asking? Because this is kind of a doorway question, isn't it, really?
Every question is.
I know. So where do you want to go?
I don't know. You've got the sheet of questions, Jim. You decide where you want to go next.
Yeah. To actually think of our life as having a personal purpose.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, that's what's been in my mind coming to tonight. Does God have a purpose for my life? It's not just, is there a purpose to life? But what about my life? Would an infinite God care about an individual as insignificant as me? You know?
That's a brilliant question, right? And from memory, one of the chapters in the book is, have you ever wondered what God thinks of you?
Right.
Which is a great question, because I think many people I've talked to about faith over the years, Jim, I've seen sort of that journey happens. People start by thinking, well, maybe there's some kind of God.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe all this is not an accident. Then the next kind of questions you move into would be, well, if there's a God, what sort of God are we talking about? Because people use the word God in all kinds of ways.
Yeah.
And then you come into the question of going, okay, well, if there's a God and it's a personal God, what does he think of me? And you've nailed it with that question. Mm. If there's a God who's infinite and has brought all of this into existence, why would he care about you and me? Mm. The answer to that, I think, is simply, we don't know. The Bible, I don't think, sets out to go, well, human beings are special. In fact, we're so amazing. We're utterly brilliant. God's doing us a favor by offering us a relationship with him. I think that's got the whole thing on his head. The God of the universe doesn't need you and I. He could have done the whole show without us. He could have created the whole of reality without us. There'd been a lot less mess in it, to be honest. He could have created us as robots, right? Where we just do what we're programmed to and we don't cause any problems, but things like love is no longer possible. But he hasn't done those things. He's chosen to create you and I, to give us the gift of life and the ability to choose and the ability to love and all of those gifts to us and has done that purely out of his love and his grace and his compassion. And so in one sense, the answer is, we don't know why he's chosen to do it. We know what the answer isn't. It isn't that God needed anything.
That's true.
Which I think is important.
Yeah. I think the danger for lots of us is that we get so self-obsessed that we think he must have a real plan for me. You know, it's the sort of, it's the Calvin and Hobbes kind of view of the world, isn't it?
Or we go one of two ways, actually, Jim. I think some of us have that danger.
Yeah.
I think there's definitely a danger that some of us have towards self-importance. And if that is the case,
I've certainly got that problem. Yeah.
I was going to say, anyone in this room who has that temptation, know who you are, and your loved ones probably know who you are as well.
Your long-suffering loved ones. Yeah.
Well, somebody once said to me that if you do think that you're basically perfect, the best cure is to get married, because your spouse will very quickly point out to you that you're not. But the other danger that you can go, actually, and that may be a reality for some here or the people we know, is you can go the other way and go, I've made such a mess of my life that God could not care about somebody like me. And I, through my life, I've bounced between those two. I think in my 20s, that was where I was far more. I wrestled with self-image issues as a 20-year-old and self-worth issues and not just with those around me, but I think that got a lot of that got projected onto God. And as I've got older, the temptation as you then grow up a bit and know a few things is that you are tempted to go the other way and go, well, you know, I've read some books, you know.
Don't you know?
I think God would be tempted to go, well, yeah. So I think the wonderful thing about the Christian faith is that it deals with both those temptations. So if you are someone who is tempted to go, well, I'm quite important, really, God looks at you and goes, well, you know that you're enough of a wretch that Jesus had to die for you. Just a little reminder just to bring you down to size. But he did, but he had to. If your temptation is the other way and to go, well, and how could God love someone like me? Mm-hmm. I think God looks at you and smiles and go, well, the answer is he couldn't, but that's why Jesus came and died for you. Because in either way, Jesus is the great leveler. And so the gospel both, I think, lifts up those who need lifting up and cuts down those who need cutting up. Cutting down, but brings us all
cutting
together.
Up.
Cutting down. Jesus is the great leveler.
Jesus is
the great leveler.
Yeah. So that if we're thinking about our life as having a purpose, we want to avoid this Messiah complex. It says, oh, this must all be for purpose. You know, the Winston Churchill moment, when he became prime minister, he said, you know, he felt that his whole life had been a preparation for this moment, sort of, and he was walking with destiny, sort of thing.
Yes, I have a horrible feeling Boris Johnson said something similar. So
I
it's not just
so, yeah.
Politicians do have this
but
tendency.
Then,
yes, Mr. Trump might also have that.
For a purpose.
Oh, that's right. He did.
He did.
Absolutely right.
Trump said, God has saved me, spared my life for a purpose.
Politicians do have this slight tendency, don't they?
Yeah.
Thankfully, you and I don't have this.
No, I do. I definitely have this problem.
that's very good. I like that. Sorry, Jim.
Yeah, so we want to avoid that,
yes,
temptation. But that means that life itself becomes invested with something valuable without us having to be this great Messiah character sort of thing.
I think that's right. And I think this is almost back to the performance-based acceptance piece that we talked about earlier, that if you don't believe in God, if atoms and particles and the here and now all that you have to try and scrabble to build your identity. It's the only way to do it. You've somehow got to make a name for yourself. Now,
we live in a celebrity culture that is so dedicated to everybody being extraordinary.
Well, I was going to say, some of us, if you've got a platform, if you're a Trump or a Johnson or a Keir Starmer, you can do it on that stage. Obviously, we live in a celebrity culture. Along came social media and allowed all of us to become celebrities. I saw some survey recently that was looking at asking young adults aged kind of 14 to 18, what they wanted to be when they left school. And there was a worrying, I think it was 20% just said famous.
Yeah.
Not famous for something, just famous.
And there are more and more ways to get famous. But
We mentioned anxiety too earlier. It's interesting. A very influential book came out last year called The Anxious Generation.
Yeah.
Jonathan Haidt, who's a psychologist.
Yeah.
And he in that book, he's not a Christian, he's got no religious faith, just talks about what's happened with social media coming in and creating this platform for young adults who feel that the only way to have value is how many people like, repost, reshare, tweet. It's done massive damage because that's the only thing you have. Whereas by contrast, if there is a God behind this universe who created you in his image, who died for you in the person of Jesus, who gives you that basis for identity, if you get that deep into your DNA, you don't have to strive to establish yourself in quite the same way. You can still work hard and be driven and all of those things, but your identity and your value doesn't depend on it. And I think that's a big, big, big difference, actually.
So how does it invest everyday life with that non-celebrity, non-famous, living your life quietly and doing it well for God's glory? So I know somebody who makes road sweepers for a living. Okay, he works in a factory and he paints road sweepers.
Oh, machines! I was thinking about your guy with the handlebar moustache. He's actually made in a factory.
Sorry. What is it about road sweepers today?
I was thinking Didcot, where the robotic road sweepers.
I know somebody who works in a factory
that makes
where they manufacture the machines that sweep roads. You know, the ones with the rotating brushes and so on. And we're very glad of those. You know, and actually, that's a brilliant thing to be doing, because without it, we'd have a public health crisis and so on. But it's never going to be famous, and it's never going to be.
Yeah, and I think the first thought there, of course, is if you are working in the road sweeping factory, and you have a Christian faith, it allows you to go, I can go into work today, and I can work on making whatever little widget I make that goes onto the road sweeper, the plastic handlebar moustache that goes on the front of the machine. And thank you, one person who laughed. And I can know that I am, even if no one else notices, my Heavenly Father notices.
In World War II, there was a poster, wasn't there, there was a poster campaign. I'm fascinated by military history. She's the girl that makes the spring that drills the hole. She's the girl that makes the thing that drills the hole that holds the spring that turns the knob that makes the thingy bob.
Yes.
It was a song as well. There you go. Yeah. And what it was trying to do was to lift up the person who is stuck in the factory making thingy bobs all the time.
But also, even if you could make it tougher, right? Because going, even that's a little bit instrumental that I'm a cog in a machine. Even let's suppose you're not a cog in a machine. Let's suppose you lose your job at the road sweeping factory. And all you can do is go and, I don't know, volunteer at the local library or something. And you might go, I'm struggling to find that chain of doing something big. It doesn't matter. You still have worth and you still have value because you're still a son or daughter of your Heavenly Father.
Yeah.
And it reminds me of a story, actually. There was a story a few years ago. There's a book, a very famous book called The Return of the Prodigal, written by... it's American form.
Henri Nouwen,
French guy. Fascinating story. He was a professor at a very esteemed university in America. I think it was Yale University. Very eminent professor. One day he goes to see a picture painted by Rembrandt called The Return of the Prodigal. It's a picture that Rembrandt painted, one of the very famous stories that Jesus told, the story of the prodigal son. Beautiful painting. You could look it up online. It's a beautiful piece of art. And Nouwen had the opportunity to actually go and see it in the gallery, I think, where it was in Russia at the time. I think it was in St. Petersburg. And he describes in his book just asking for a chair to be brought. And he sits in front of this picture for most of the day, actually, just watching the light play across it, moved to tears by the way that picture so beautifully portrays that story of Jesus that portrays the love of God for even the prodigal. So struck that he is by the love of God for any of us. He goes back to America, resigns his professorship, and spends the rest of his life working at a home for profoundly mentally disabled children, just doing fairly menial work. But I think we'd say just the joy he got out of serving out and living out the purpose that he'd been called to. He didn't need that big stage. Mm. He enjoyed the smile of his Heavenly Father, even while picking up the poo of profoundly disabled people who could look after themselves. And that his story is really interesting because there's a man who, when confronted with the love of God, gave up status because he no longer felt he needed it.
He could have been a lifelong celebrated teacher.
And he chose not to. So take that down into the everyday. If you're putting screws into the road sweeping machine, if you're volunteering at the old folks' home or the local library, or even if you're like bedridden because you're ill and you can't do anything.
Or you're the carer for the bedridden person who's given up their career as an accountant or a businessman or whatever.
I had friends who've been in that very situation of going, your life still is worthwhile because it's not about what you do, it's about what God has done for you.
Yeah. And your part in this great mesh that is the world and life is done for His glory. Not your own self-seeking, and therefore it has value and it has worth. Yeah.
And I think it transforms how you see life, the universe, and everything, because you no longer have to, I think, fight for status.
Yeah.
You can relax And that still means, by the way, you can enjoy your job if you love making road sweeping machines, or you love teaching, or you love being an engineer, or whatever it is you're doing. That's fantastic. But it means you can, I think you can enjoy it more, because it becomes a source of pleasure in serving others, not necessarily the way by which you acquire your identity and your value.
And if you just go on down another rabbit hole into the world of art, we were discussing the wonderful art on the cover of this book.
Yes.
If you take God out of the picture, as a lot of 20th century art did, you end up with something a bit like a Jackson Pollock painting, very nihilistic, just a splodge of why and what and what on earth does that mean? But Christians who are engaged with art are doing their art for the glory of God and wanting to bring out design and detail and beauty and so on. I'm not saying non-Christian artists aren't interested in beauty, but there was a sort of a period in the mid-20th century where art became very soulless because God was gone.
I think Rembrandt's
what motivated Rembrandt to paint as he did was missing, and it shows.
And I think, by the way, you can apply the same thing if there are some of you around this room who enjoy music. The same thing applies. You know, why is it, for example, that one of the most famous pieces of classical music ever written, whether you are into classical music or you aren't, you know, Handel's Messiah.
Yeah.
You know, most people recognize that piece of music if it comes on the radio because it's so well known. Why has it had the impact that it has? Would it have had the same impact if Handel had written that, I don't know, about the motion of atoms? In fact, there was a very famous, it's almost like when you, if you watch it on YouTube, you'll think it's a parody. But a group of scientists, secular scientists at CERN, which is the big particle accelerator in Switzerland, 17-mile tube under the ground, where they crash particles into each other to try and, you know, solve great questions of life. There's a choir there. And a few years ago, they wrote a song. They tried to do a sort of piece of classical music, sort of celebrating the Higgs boson, which was this particle they were trying to find. It is the most horrific piece of music you will ever hear. If you look it up on YouTube, your first thought would be, this is a joke. And they weren't joking. They were trying to do, you know, something
and
wonderful.
There was no soul there.
So. And there's no soul there. And that's before we get into questions like, why does art matter? You know, I'm someone who loves, you know, natural landscapes. I'm a hiker, a mountaineer. That's my hobby. I love climbing, you know, great sweeping mountains. That's why I moved to Swindon and from Scotland. And I remember once talking to a friend who was also a hiker and a climber, and he had no faith in God. He was an atheist. And I said, hey, have you ever thought about what is it that moves us to drag our sorry backsides, you know, for hours up this hillside, you know, sweat and mosquitoes and everything, standing here, look at this view. Why are we drawn to natural landscapes? And he thought for a moment and he went, yeah, that's a good question, isn't it? He said, I think it goes back, we like natural landscapes because, you know, hundreds of thousands of years ago, our prehistoric ancestors would have known that, you know, like a valley like this with fields and a river running through it was a good place to hunt game. And so that instinct lives on. I remember looking at him and going, John, I said, 4 years ago, I had the privilege, I went on the trip of a lifetime, and I got to go to Everest in Tibet and go to base camp and look at the massive hanging glaciers on the north face of Everest. I went, at no point in my brain did it occur to me that I might want to go up into those glaciers and try hunting wildebeest. It fails as an explanation.
Yeah.
And I think our draw, that we're drawn to art and music and beauty is a clue. And by the way, you mentioned that the cover, who I think the publishers did an amazing job on. One of the big ideas in the book, Jim, is that, you know, each of these things on its own, the fact that purpose doesn't make sense without God, on its own you might go, if you're not a religiously inclined person, you might go, okay, interesting, but yeah, I'm not convinced. Or if it was just beauty or music, you might go, yeah, interesting, but I'm not sure. There are 28 different of those kind of wandering questions in the book that all kind of line up on the same direction, that all look to be clues and indicators and signposts that something bigger is going on. There's a bigger story out there.
And that was the story of C.S. Lewis, wasn't it? That he was an ardent atheist. He was living with a woman in Oxford who he wasn't married to and was quite, you know...
Mrs. Moore?
Yeah, he was, you know... quite open in his rebellion against the Christian values of the time. And in the 1920s, that was extraordinary. And yet, his love of beauty and his admiration of the natural world around him, you know, he lived near the town where I grew up when he was a teenager in Surrey, and he loved the Mole Valley and looking out over the Mole Valley and seeing the beauty of it. And these were filling him with a desire that this world could not satisfy. So what was his famous conclusion? It's once I've looked at all of that.
So, well, there's a couple of things about Lewis, known quite widely, obviously now famous as a Christian writer. You know, he was the author of the Narnia books, Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, and all those kind of things, works of Christian fiction as well as works of Christian theology. You're right, he was a committed atheist for the first 30 years of his life, very hardcore atheist, actually, not just I don't believe in God. I mean, a really angry...
Very anti.
Very, 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 very anti. And there's a famous line of his in his diary when he was in World War One in the trenches, and you know, everything was awful. The Battle of the Somme, you know, his best mate blown to pieces next to him. He writes in his diary, you know, however bad it was in France in the trenches, I never sank so low as to pray. Yeah, he was pretty hardcore. But then, as you say, he comes back to the UK, and in his late 20s, early 30s, he's now teaching at Oxford, loves literature, loves art, loves music. And he slowly and slowly and slowly came to this conclusion that all the things that he cared the most about, that brought him joy, made utterly no sense on atheism. And he begins this slow journey, actually, from atheism. His first major stop was just believing in God, a viewpoint called theism. In fact, this is another amazing line in his diary, a very famous line, where he first really realizes there is a God. And he describes how he said, you know, in the Trinity term, whatever year it was, I finally fell to my knees and prayed. I gave in, fell to my knees and prayed. At that moment, the most reluctant convert in the whole of England. Because he didn't like the idea there was a God. He was just too smart to deny it. And it was actually 2 years later that he figured out where Jesus fitted into the whole story and became
a Christian. Had his famous journey to Whipsnade Zoo where he finally surrendered and trusted in Jesus.
That's it. Yeah. In a sidecar of a motorbike driven by his brother, I think.
Somewhere between Oxford and Whipsnade Zoo. So,
that's right.
Somewhere between Tame and Haddonham. I don't know. Yeah.
Where else would you not discover the reality of life?
Maybe it was Aston Clinton. Yeah.
I like to think so.
Yeah. Okay. I've done a lot of questioning and we've gone down numerous rabbit holes.
Yeah, rabbit trails everywhere, aren't
they? Yeah. That's the way my brain is working at the end of a tiring day. What questions do you have for Andy? Let's have 10 minutes of questions from you rather than from me.